You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We are sifting through midterm election results across the state and country. From highly competitive races in California and beyond, the balance of Congress is still taking shape. But within the unknowns of these election returns are broader themes and messages of where voters stand and what issues fueled them to the polls. We're going to have a roundtable of analysis. Joining us are Laurel Rosenhall with the LA Times, political strategist Luis Alvarado, and Paul Mitchell with the ballot tracking firm Political Data, Inc. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks.
Hello. Thanks.
Hello.
When preparing for this segment, I was like, where do we begin? Oh, my gosh, like so much overstimulation the morning after a midterm. So, you know, many pivotal races obviously have yet to be called. Things are still taking shape. But I'm just curious, when you all are waking up this morning, what was the big headline or the big takeaway for you? Paul, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big takeaway is, you know, we saw nationally not as big of a red wave as a lot of folks had expected. At the beginning of the night, you saw Republicans winning Florida's governor's race and Senate race, and you thought, okay, well, this is what we're in for. But with Fetterman winning, with a lot of the congressional seats, it just didn't look like this red wave, which would have been expected in a midterm election with Democrats in power and a focus on economic and inflation issues. You would have expected a red wave, but it didn't really materialize. And like we saw in 2010 in California, even as Republicans did gain a lot of seats nationally, so about probably 10, maybe 12 seats nationally, they did regain control of the House, where Kevin McCarthy will likely be the next speaker. In California, it looks like everything's going to stay pat. I think our projection right now is that Democrats will hold the seats that they were holding going into this election cycle, and Republicans will hold theirs.
Hmm. Luis, what about you?
Well, I echo what Paul's saying. The one thing that's bright for at least Republicans in California is that many of those Republican seats stayed put as it looks so far. I think Garcia already claimed victory. And it looks like Katie Porter is still in the balance as one that was going to be flipped for Republicans. And Kevin McCarthy, so far, like Paul said, seems to be the guy who's going to be running the Congress in the next few years.
Yeah. Laurel, you have long covered California politics. What stands out to you about how the results are shaping up this morning?
I think that at the statewide level here in California, things have gone, you know, exactly as predicted, in contrast to what we saw at the national level, where there seems to be some feeling of surprise this morning that things maybe didn't go as Republican as had been expected. At the statewide level in California, it's just the results so far prove yet again that there's really no opportunity for Republicans to win statewide office in California. The margins are just overwhelming for the Democrats across the statewide offices. And in the one open race where we had the state controller's race, where there was the Republican Lonnie Chen, who had a lot of bipartisan appeal, a lot of support from independents, ran an outstanding campaign, had a very compelling message about, you know, accountability, and using the audit power. He was not at all going for kind of red meat Republican messaging whatsoever. He did great on fundraising, and, you know, and he's not close to winning at all. So I think that, you know, when it comes to statewide races in California, in that regard, no surprises, Democrats dominate. Mm.
You know, Luis, nationally, the party of the president historically doesn't fare well in midterm elections, coupled with President Biden's low approval rating. I mean, analysts really predicted it was the GOP's midterm to lose, and that may not necessarily happen, but it wasn't this red wave as Paul was talking about. So with this, that Republican lens, can you put into context the performance of GOP candidates on a national level?
I think GOP candidates did not fare well with the expectation that they had, despite of President Biden's low poll ratings, Democrats were able to connect directly with the voters in their own districts. I think Republicans who hitched their wagons to Mar-a-Lago were greatly disappointed. And also giving a perspective to 2024 with DeSantis watching the chessboard, Republicans are now basically in limbo with regards to who is going to be the head of the Republican Party moving away from this election. And Republicans truly did have an opportunity to have that red wave. And I think they just did not run an operation that actually connected with the voters. I think America is actually a little bit tired of Trumpism, and they're ready for something new. But the question is DeSantis that answer? And that now we have a much larger question mark than we had before entering.
Yeah. Paul, in California, what is voter turnout shaping up to be? Is it strong or is it weak compared to prior midterms?
Well, it's always hard to compare to prior midterms. You know, our voter file has grown so much. You know, if we look back to like a 2014, there would have been 17 million voters. If we look at 2018, there was 20 million voters. We're at over 22 million voters that will be, you know, have received a ballot or voted in this election. I would expect a 50% mark is a good kind of place to kind of look right now. We only have tabulated some of the early votes, votes that maybe were received by county registrars up through Friday or Saturday, plus the in-person votes that were cast in some counties over the weekend and on Tuesday, in other counties just the Tuesday votes. Then we still have a lot of mail-in ballots that are coming in, ballots that were dropped off at the drop boxes and have to be signature verified. We have weeks of tabulating all of this, and so just for perspective, I think a 50% turnout is a good kind of guess right now.
Yeah, I was thinking it's like a pour over coffee. It's not drip, you know. It takes a little bit longer. You know, when it comes to Governor Newsom, handedly won re-election, votes obviously still coming in. And I know that it's hard to compare to previous election years, just given that we have more people who are registered to vote. But how does his margin fare compared to his 2018 election or even the recall? Or is it fair to compare them?
I think it's fair to compare them. You know, I think this was an extraordinary large victory for him. It's not like, you know, in elections in the past, even Jerry Brown, when he was running for governor and re-election, he had more challenging elections that he had to deal with. This election for Governor Newsom really was a bit of a gimme putt. He came out of the recall election extremely strong, not just because he had good numbers and won by a large margin, but also because some of those top tier Republicans who I think kind of the Republican consultant class would have expected to rise up and be a real general election challenger to the governor someday, they ended up literally in single digits out of the recall, and their donors were burned out. The math just didn't seem to be there. And in a way, other than that controller's race, the Republican Party has somewhat right now receded to be more of a regional party. You see the real importance for the Republicans in trying to win some of these congressional districts around the state. There are county supervisors and local government where Republicans are extremely strong. But right now, and I don't expect this to be permanent, but right now there aren't really opportunities for Republicans at the statewide level.
Yeah. Luis, his challenger, Republican State Senator Brian Dahle, I mean, obviously he lost, but he currently, percentage-wise, I mean, results are still coming in, currently garnered 42% of the returns so far. Is there a success story within this loss?
Not really. With regards to what Paul was saying is that Republicans don't hold a constitutional office anywhere in the state, and it doesn't look in the near future that we will. But the question, I think, is more prevalent is, you know, what do conservatives, as opposed to Republicans, what do conservatives do to ensure that they have some say with regards to governance? And in Los Angeles, we saw a Republican, prior lifelong Republican, turn Democrat, now as
Rick Caruso. In the mayoral race. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, it's like a razor thin margin. I was going to talk about that later. Yeah, but go ahead.
but that goes to what's the formula for conservatives to have a voice in governance? And many are turning and they're changing the registration either to independents, no party preference, or straight up Democrats. And, you know, I've actually run some Democrats in this election cycle who have told me, you know what, 20 years ago, I would have been a Republican, but there's no way I can win. being that carrying that label, so I have to register as a Democrat. And now what we see is an internal fight in California between extreme left Democrat versus your blue dog Democrat. And I think that is now something that's going to be seen in the future for California between candidates. And we see that in Los Angeles in real life right now.
Yeah. Laurel, when it comes to Governor Newsom, what do you think a second term will look like for the governor? I mean, leading up to the midterm, he reached out to a national audience. There were ads in Republican states taking on, you know, like governors like Ron DeSantis, for example. Do you think there's going to be a continuation of this, or do you think Newsom will turn inward and focus on the state's really most pressing issues like homelessness, housing, and cost of living?
I expect that he's going to do both. I'm sort of looking at it on two tracks. There's going to be the political Newsom that's continuing to try to lead the Democratic pushback nationally on all kinds of culture war issues and really try to come out there as this progressive warrior representing the left worldview. And then I think there's going to be the policy side and what he's going to do in Sacramento as far as governing. And in that regard, he really should focus on implementing the things that he passed in his first term, because his first term was sort of a bonanza of passing very large, in some cases, groundbreaking, sweeping new policies. But most of them are, and I'm talking about things like this new care court to compel treatment for people who are addicted to drugs or mentally ill and living on the streets. Preschool for all four-year-olds, healthcare for all low-income residents of the state, regardless of immigration status. Phasing out the sale of new gasoline-powered cars. Closing. I mean, he has passed an enormous amount of changes, but all of those things are set to phase in the next several years. None of them have been completed so far. So he signed the law, but whether they're going to be successful laws, that's what's going to be determined in the second year. I mean, in the second term. And so on the governing side, he really needs to focus on implementing these things so that he doesn't, you know, leave in 2 years or 4 years or whenever it is and have a bunch of bills that he signed, but a bunch of sort of half-baked plans.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the next, you know, 2 to 4 years, because the governor stated in his only debate that he is committed to completing his term for governor if reelected. That would take him to 2026. Laurel, what's your confidence level the governor makes good on that with the 2024 presidential election coming up?
I think it entirely depends on factors that are outside of his control. So it will, you know, depend on who else is in the mix for the presidential race in a couple of years. He's said he's not going to run. If Joe Biden is running, I'm sure he won't run. If there's Joe Biden's not running and there's kind of a questionable field and he gets a lot of pressure to run, you know, I could imagine him doing it. But I also understand he can't go into a re-election campaign saying that he's going to, you know, bail in a year or two. That obviously doesn't work. So I'm sure plan A is that he's going to, you know, stick it out as governor for 4 years. But all the signs of what he's doing externally point toward that he's preparing himself. He's preparing himself for the eventuality that maybe Democrats will want him to run. And he wants to be, you know, in position to be a contender if that's the case. That's what all the signs are pointing toward, even though that's not what he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Luis, following the recall last year, you provided some analysis. And when the governor handedly defeated the recall attempt, you said that Newsom could run for president if he wants to. You know, so I guess what are your thoughts? What's your confidence level on the governor, you know, completing his 4-year term or potentially, you know, flirting with the idea of throwing his hat into the race for the presidential election in 2024?
No, I agree with Laurel. It's what the outside Astros are going to, what the stars are need to be aligned just right. But so far, I remember watching an SNL skit over the weekend about Biden as the nominee. And truly, I don't think anybody consciously can see that he will be the nominee. The question is, what kind of mechanism is going to be enacted to find that new nominee if Biden is not it? And what's that going to look like? And the same thing applies to the Republicans. You know, we're looking at a dance with candidates, and they're going to have to try to work with donors and try to take control of their committees, and there has to be a communication strategy. And none of these things seem to be clear for any of the parties at this point. But certainly, I have no question in my mind that Gavin Newsom is going to be one of the prime characters in this story.
You know, Paul, looking at national returns, I mean, Governor Newsom received a lot of votes for re-election. Going over to the southeast, to Florida, Governor DeSantis did as well. What stands out to these both of these wins, given that, you know, they're kind of viewed nationally as these polarizing figures that would make a potentially good matchup if they debated?
Oh, yeah, it would be a great matchup if they debated. And I did hear a rumor, actually, that there was a higher education institution in the country that had offered their location up for a debate between Santis and Newsom. We'll see if something like that were ever to happen. First off, stepping back, the Rubio and DeSantis wins in Florida and how early those were called and how large they were, that is actually probably really good news for Republicans going into the 2024 presidential election. Florida does not look as purple as we might have thought in 2014 or 2016, you know. And so that really does lock down, I think, Florida as being a solidly Republican red state. When you look nationally at a lot of these races, one of the things that strikes me is that Newsom does have a message he's trying to give to Democrats around the country. And that's one of really pushing back and fighting against Republicans on core Democratic issues. It's no mistake that Gavin Newsom helped with this, you know, Prop 1 push and, you know, putting abortion rights into the state constitution. Noteworthy that abortion measure, which would have seemed really controversial 10 years ago, actually got more votes than any other state ballot measure, got more votes than any other state constitutional office. So it was,
including the governor's race.
Including the governor's race. So it was the biggest winner on election night, something that a lot of people would have thought 10, 20 years ago was kind of like a third rail you wouldn't want to touch. Now, around the country, the abortion issue was on the ballot in 5 states. And the pro-choice, pro-abortion camps won all 5 of those ballot measures around the country. Newsom's message has been, we need to own these progressive issues. We need to fight on these issues. We need to reframe the debate. And a lot of the stuff that's been happening nationally does seem like the messaging is a little bit more on its heels, where a lot of Democrats are being told, oh, well, you really do have to, like, talk about inflation or gas prices or the economy more. And it's not that Democrats don't need to have answers on those issues. It's more of a stylistic thing. And DeSantis has a stylistic approach with his Republican messaging that is in some ways that big embrace of those core principles in the same way that Gavin does. If we did ever have a head-to-head debate there, that would be one to watch. A lot more interesting than the Dolly Newsom race.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in a president, someone who isn't president anymore, but has a great deal of influence, obviously, is President Trump. And when it comes to Trump-backed candidates nationally, they kind of struggled more compared to Republican candidates who were not backed by Trump. I mean, I think of Georgia with the governor's race compared to the Senate race. What about former President Trump? I mean, where does this lead him? Because there is still a lot of speculation whether he will actually run in 2024.
Well, you know, a lot of this is rumor stuff, but there was a rumor that he was going to be announcing in a couple weeks. I think he has a scheduled event in 15 days or something like that, where one would presume that that's when he's going to announce that he's going to run for president. I know a lot of Democrats were hoping he would announce for president before the election to really put the midterm spotlight on Trump and his potential return to, you know, the political center stage, rather than having the spotlight be on Biden. His, like you mentioned, you know, he didn't do as well. Oz Fetterman, you know, he was backing Oz, and that was a big loss for him. Around the state, there were a lot of other congressional races that are just not as well known, where the kind of Trumpier candidates didn't end up winning on Election Day. So there is potentially some soul searching to be had there, but I don't really see former President Donald Trump as a real soul searcher.
Yeah.
I think he'll probably come out of this fighting still.
Yeah, and he still has strong supporters as well. Luis, when it comes to former President Trump and his influence and his support, I mean, where do you think that stands? What conversations are happening within the Republican Party about where they go from here for 2024, even with potentially what could become House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who is a very strong has a very strong tie to President Trump?
I agree. There are many conversations being had right now, mostly with donors and members who lead the committees, you know, the RNCs specifically, with regards to who's going to be making the decisions where the money goes. Let's be frank. Donald Trump has overtaken all the committees. He has owned the Republican Party. But I think last night is the first time that there has been a true repudiation of what MAGA stands for. I was watching some of those candidates attempting to elevate a conversation about, you know, ballots being snuck into the process again and actually not being received as they thought it would. The excuses are no longer going to be valid for those that are MAGA-like candidates. And it's a little bit of optimist for those Republicans that are considered the sane Republicans, the reasonable Republicans, to have an opportunity to start looking at 2024 for other races where they felt that they couldn't be allowed to have any kind of oxygen. Now they have the possibility of fighting for conservative seats that Democrats have been expecting to continue to hold or to push against Republicans. So for me, it's kind of like a moment of glee, knowing that Republicans are starting to break the fever. But the question still remains, you know, the patient still has control of the money purse, and we'll see what happens with other candidates that are going to percolate, hopefully, for 2024.
Well, switching gears, we can table that because there's a good amount of discussions that we'll be having on that in the weeks and months and a couple of years to come. You know, I want to talk about voter engagement, who actually showed up. We've been having discussions on Inside about Hispanic Americans, the Latino vote nationally. I mean, there's just huge potential there for this voting bloc, including in California. Luis, I mean, let's talk about the Latino vote. I mean, does California's turnout mirror nationally? I mean, what is it looking like so far? And who are they voting for, right? Because they're not a monolith.
Well, we have never been a monolith, but I think now more than ever, we are becoming more diverse ideologically. And as Latinos see themselves more as just general population, regular voting Americans, the issues are the ones that are the common issues, like the economy, crime, and even abortion have become more prevalent in the way they look at the vote. But still, you have to have the platform to be able to talk to the issues pertaining to the communities themselves and finding leadership that actually can address the issues that they have. Hmm. And I think both parties have a lot still to gain with regards to how they talk to Latinos. And maybe that is why we're starting to see Latinos move from one side to the other in different election cycles, because the issues are the ones that are moving, not the party itself, but it's the message. And that gives me a little bit of happiness to see. But at the same time, we know that there are more Latinos that are eligible to vote. We are a young voting population, and it's up to the parties and the elected and the candidates to actually find ways to communicate with this community, because so far we're seeing, at least for example, I'm going to jump back to Los Angeles. We saw the Caruso campaign spend a lot of money with Latinos. And the only reason, in my view, is that he is in this fight is because he had a very precise campaign strategy and how he was going to reach out to Latinos, not as monolithic, but as individuals, like Salvadorians, Mexican Americans, seniors. There was actually an investment, and I think it's a paying off for him.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to like my side of the family, which is like Mexican and also Cuban. And yeah, you sit us at a dinner table, which probably will happen at Thanksgiving. Very different political views. Laurel, why do you think the LA mayoral race is so tight right now between Democrat Karen Bass and, as Luis was talking about, Republican turned Democrat Rick Caruso?
Well, I think we can't discount the record-breaking amount of money that Rick Caruso put into his campaign. He's a real estate developer with great, you know, personal wealth, and he, I think, outspent Karen Bass by a margin of 13-1, if I'm not mistaken, at least 10-1. So yes, that outreach that Luis is talking about is done with a lot of money, and so it's an effective strategy that's backed by a lot of money. So you can't forget about that. I think that's one factor. It's not the only one, but that's a big one that we can't discount.
Paul, ending with you, when it comes, you joined us about a week ago when we're talking about the ballot returns for early mail-in voting. What is turnout looking like? I mean, is this kind of the typical voting patterns, the typical people that are showing up, or is it evolving?
I mean, it really is evolving still. We know the votes that came in that were mailed in early and early drop box votes because the county registrars, as they were receiving these ballots, were logging them and letting us know who those voters were. And like we've talked about in the past, those early voters are generally older, whiter, more affluent, more from, you know, homeowners from suburban areas. And then we generally see kind of a spike near the end of those younger voters, Latinos, independent voters, and we won't really know the final turnout and the composition of the electorate probably for a couple months. At that point, people won't care as much when I put out a little report that says who voted in the general election, because we'll be talking about the next presidential by then. But come maybe January, we'll really know the true composition. And it will vary around the state. You know, in Los Angeles, we did have that competitive mayor's race, and we look at who voted in this general election. Some really striking numbers from this morning. 40% of the people who voted in this general election hadn't voted in the primary.
Wow.
And
what do you think that says?
Well, it says that there were, you know, the campaigns were going out trying to get people who were expressly like non-voters in the primary, particularly Caruso's campaign. And while Laurel's right, money does matter a huge amount. The fact that they spent about, you know, 15% of their budget, roughly $15 million on field, and the focus of their field program was getting out voters who hadn't voted in the primary but were Caruso supporters. It's very likely that at the end of the day, the story, aside from just the money piece, will be about the fact that they did an extensive field program, the likes we've never seen in this state or this country, more money being spent on efforts like door knocking and language, going out and phone banking and texting people from those communities, real grassroots outreach that was obviously paid for by the Caruso campaign, but done in a way and at a scale that we hadn't seen before. And it could be the thing that allows this race to kind of defy the polling, too, because they were getting out a lot of voters that weren't expected. I don't think any polls were saying, here's our likely voter universe. It includes 40% of people that didn't vote in the primary.
Yeah. Well, Paul,
I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Luis.
I would imagine that's what helped Garcia maintain his seat in Valladares. Republicans who were defending their seats against well-funded Democrats as well, getting conservatives, Democrats to come out and also looking at those other candidates as an option for them.
Hmm. Well, Luis, Paul, and Laurel, thank you so much. We just tipped the iceberg. You know, there's still so much to talk about, but I appreciate y'all making the time.
Have a great day.
My pleasure.
Bye. And that is Laurel Rosenhall with the LA Times, political strategist Luis Alvarado, and Paul Mitchell with the ballot tracking firm Political Data, Inc. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.